Hello and welcome to another episode of The Grey NATO. It's a loose discussion of travel, adventure, diving, driving gear, and most certainly watches. This is episode 363, and it's proudly brought to you by the always growing TGN supporter crew. We thank you all so much for your continued support, and if you're listening and would like to support the show, please visit thegreynato.com for more details. My name is James Stacey, and I'm joined as ever by my friend and co-host, Jason Heaton. Jason, how are we doing?
Well, I'm doing okay, and I'll do my best to keep you awake for the next hour.
Yeah, I don't know if I will keep the like eight errors I made in three sentences there. I don't know if I'll keep those in the recording. I'm fairly jet lagged. You know, I'm usually pretty good coming home, but coming back from Japan seems to be able to do it. I did sleep last night. I don't know that I slept all that well. I was definitely up and down, as was my baby son, and yeah, so I'm feeling pretty fuzzy at the moment. You guys can time it out over the next hour or so. I will ingest another four espressos as we sit here, and then we'll figure out how it goes from there. So, how have you been?
Yeah, I'm doing fine. I mean, it makes me wonder about, you know, there's so many theories about jet lag, and you know how many days you're gone versus how many hours it takes to get back to normal and whatever. And it was a quick trip for you. It was what, Friday through Tuesday? I guess that's enough to settle in.
Yeah. And I we don't talk about this a ton, and maybe it's not even that interesting. Often I find most people talking about AI to be, it's like I'm falling asleep unless you're kind of predicting how things could go. This trip was originally going to somebody else at Hodinkee, then they couldn't make it, so I took it. And it was for the launch of this new LV collab. They do these major launches, not quite every year, but close to, where they're doing five of them total. This is the third one, and they partner with like a notable independent watchmaker, and they make something really next level, right? So the first one was a Recep Recepi with a dial on each side of the watch. The second one was a Kari watch from, again, Kari Voutilainen. And this third one was for De Batoon. And the watch is fairly conventional, especially within the De Batoon sense, a very unconventional brand, the LVDB03 GMT. But they also made two Sympatique clocks, which is something simply nobody does. And actually, the last time it was done, it was largely done by the same person who made this one, Denis Flagiolet. It's an interesting story. If you want to go deeper into it, it's on Hodinkee. My coverage is on Hodinkee. That said, it's perhaps about as far away from being a TGN watch as a titanium sport watch with a GMT function could be. You know, it's about $500,000 once you pay your taxes. I think 375,000 euros. So you do the math for you. And then the clock is like 4 million euros. So it's not really within our scope. It is an incredible, especially the clock, wildly cool thing and execution and story and the rest of it. But not the sort of thing that we typically cover here on the show. But that's what took me to Japan. And when I got the trip, I asked ChatGPT how I could adjust my sleep schedule.
Yeah.
To kind of help me get ready for it. So it gave me some ideas, and I took those in. And going there, I actually don't know that I experienced any jet lag. I had like a plan for the first week or so before the trip, and then how to sleep on the plane. So I really felt relatively fine. I was getting 5-6 hours of sleep a night. So that would put me up fairly early in Tokyo. But it's a great city to walk around. And it was also, you know, these press trips are kind of, Once the itinerary starts for the day, you're just with everybody until you go to bed.
Yeah.
So having 2-3 hours to either work on stories or cover emails or whatever, or just to walk aimlessly around and eat egg salad sandos really worked out just fine. There's zero complaints in any of that, but if I sound a little loopy, please know if you hear me leave an edit in like an error, that's because I got tired of editing out the other 20. You know, I used up all my edit, you know, allotment mentally. Because we're also, due to the thing, we're recording this like 20 hours before the show goes live. So I'll edit this and then it'll go up pretty shortly thereafter. So kind of an in the moment sort of show, not our normal plan. But yeah, that's how it's been.
Yeah,
Tokyo is fun. I mean, it's just the coolest place. Got to visit the New York bar at the Park Hyatt, which is the, you know, where Lost in Translation is shot. Yeah. And it just recently underwent like a 2-year renovation. From what I can tell, at least they didn't change anything. They just redid what was already in the exact same way that it was, because it still feels like you're stepping back into Lost in Translation for that time. And there were some people playing jazz, and I was hanging out with my buddy Michael. And I don't know that I would go there just for the drinks and the jazz. It's an alcohol friendly city, to say the least. You could do pretty well in a bunch of different settings. But if you want to go for the kind of the fun of walking through the lobby, of going through a few of the floors, which all feel like set pieces from the movie, and then sitting down at the bar, it is a good time. And in that scope, for me, was worth the cover charge.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember one time I guess it was probably for the Seiko trip years ago. I stayed at the Imperial Hotel in Tokyo, which is across from the Imperial Gardens there, Emperor's Gardens. And I just recently learned, I remember I took that trip in late November and went to the Frank Lloyd Wright studio and home near Chicago, and learned that, and I think I knew this, but that Frank Lloyd Wright designed the Imperial Hotel in Tokyo. And I just couldn't remember that. But speaking of the bar, I remember, I remember some of those high views. And I also remember my room when I stayed there was on a really high floor, and it's probably a fairly common, I'm not sure, but there was an earthquake while I was there. And I could feel kind of this, being 30 floors up or whatever in this room, kind of feeling this, it's a very unfamiliar feeling for me, living in a place that really doesn't have earthquakes. And it was a little disconcerting, to have a city full of really tall buildings when there's
sure
common earthquakes. But yeah, the views are amazing. I mean, they just go on forever. And I'm definitely more of a nature guy. I'm not a city person, but there's something impressive about looking out at this expanse of glittering high rises that just go on forever.
It's so big. Like at any moment you are kind of some distance from real nature, if you will.
Yeah.
But there are some, very impressive city park garden scenarios right in the city.
Yeah.
We had a great walk through an absolutely beautiful one. Yeah, it was a fun trip. It's a remarkable city. It's one of the few places where I go, I would absolutely, as a younger man, have thought about trying to make a way of living here.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
I don't fathom how they can have, so many multiples in terms of population and vehicles and that sort of thing, and so much less traffic than Toronto.
Oh yeah.
You know what I mean? Like it's just, there's things about the city that just make so much more sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's always a treat to be there. I'm already looking forward to, maybe it's something where I get lucky enough to be there once a year, once every couple of years. I would love to see more of the country now that I've had two very short trips in Tokyo. I'd love to see more of the country. I'd love to do more of it sort of self-directed rather than in a press itinerary scenario.
Yeah. You have to explain a cryptic text message that you sent me. It was the last one I got from you while you were there. It says, we were talking about when we were going to record the episode, and you said, I'll do notes on the plane off to the sumo stables.
Oh, yeah.
What are the sumo stables? I mean, I could guess.
So it's where they kind of train.
Oh,
so there's a certain number of sumo stables. I only know a little bit that I learned through translation in the car to the stables.
Mm-hmm.
I would have to do more reading about it, but obviously sumo wrestling is very much a sporting event in Japan and in some of the neighboring countries. And we got to go into a stable like that includes like a viewing area.
Oh,
so there's almost like a seating area to the side of the sort of workout space for these guys.
Mm-hmm.
And we got to watch a master sumo wrestler kind of looking over 12 or 13 prospects.
Oh, okay.
That kind of ranged in terms of their qualifications, their ranking, their sort of structure in the system.
Yeah.
And man, I'll be honest, we were in the car going over and I thought for sure this was going to be boring. I was just sure of it. I was like, yeah, it's sumos. I've seen it on TV. I've seen a Discovery World channel sort of special once or twice when I was a kid, that sort of thing. Man, in person, it was great. These guys were fascinating. Watching them kind of go through like warm-ups and then kind of go through more like staged competition was quite exciting.
Yeah Every time Japan comes up or crosses my consciousness, I always, it makes me want to pull out You Only Live Twice. If you're jet lagged and you're looking for an easy Bond film to watch over the next few days while you're jet lagged, I think you'd enjoy, if you haven't seen it, or if you already have, like to review that one. It's all in Tokyo, and it's such a good one. And there's a sumo scene in that one.
Yeah, for sure. I bet you I haven't seen that movie in, 20 years.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I might even, it might have been one that I watched when I was even younger on like somebody's VHS.
Oh, sure.
Like taped from the TV.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, I don't know that I've actually seen that movie in its theatrical release. that might have been from a Paramount or a TCM or Peachtree TV or something like that.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Who knows? But yeah, I'll have to check that out. But yeah, the trip was really fun. You want to know the weird thing? So you know, there's what 35 to nearly 40 million people in Tokyo. Hmm. The one day we decided we would go to the Broadway Mall, which is where a lot of like secondhand watches are sold.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I've been there.
And so like Jack Road and Good Watch, those are all in this one mall. But the mall is also like weird, not weird, that's unfair. The mall is also a lot of like anime subculture stuff and other collectibles. I found like a little tiny diecast of the Ford Explorer from Jurassic Park.
Oh.
So that's what I bought for myself for the trip. You know, it was like 3,000 yen or something.
Yeah.
And I was very excited about it. Of course, the other people who were with me were just kind of like blank stares. You know, they had like thousands. I could have picked any car you could imagine. And when I saw this, I just felt like it was speaking to me.
Yeah.
I have the plastic toy, like the, or it definitely had, I'm not sure I still have all of it. I have it somewhere in a box for my mom, like the the one that you could put the figurines in and could be attacked by the T-Rex that had like the little stake that came out of his rib cage to show damage or whatever. Anyway, so that's what I got while I was there. But when we were there and we're standing out front waiting to meet up with a friend of mine who knows the area, and I realize, oh, look, there's Neil from Citizen.
Crazy. Wow.
Like, I knew he was going to be there because we had traded a couple texts. And I said, you know, if we're putting something together, I'll reach out. And then we're just standing 15 feet apart on a street in Tokyo and in an area I didn't really even plan to go to. We kind of decided to go to there, like, I wouldn't say like last minute, but without a real intent of like, I was kind of hoping to find those vending machines that have the like the G-Shock rings. I thought my daughters would enjoy those.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought there was a chance I'd find some there. So I was just looking for something to do. And then we get there and we see Neil. So Jeez. That was exciting. Shout out, Neil. I hope you're having a fantastic time. He was in town for a little bit of tourism and then some stuff with Citizen. Hmm. So who knows? Maybe they've got, well, not who knows. I'm sure they've got some exciting stuff coming out for the year, but he'll know what it is before we do. But yeah, it was fun. It doesn't seem like the kind of city where you run into somebody,
right?
That you know, it just doesn't. But yeah, so that was exciting and super fun. I guess when you think about it, like, there are a list of very common watch spots,
right?
And we were there at the same time, so that must raise our chances exponentially from near zero. But yeah, it's still funny to run into Neil and such a treat to see a friendly face.
Yeah. Yeah, that Jack Road or that whole mall with the watch shops in there is kind of mind blowing. I mean, I heard about it before I went. I think I went with Robert Jan from Fratello on that trip. Nice. And we wandered around there and my mind was blown. I mean, there's just glass cases full of, you know, multiples of vintage Ploprofs and, you know, there's a whole shop that's dedicated to British military watches. So you get, you know, the CWCs and Lamanias and old Omegas and stuff. I mean, it's just, and I remember the words of caution from somebody who'd been there before and kind of told me like, well, you know, they're all over polished and, you know, overworked and whatever. But I regardless, my mind was just blown. And I think I couldn't do I think we talked about this on your previous trip to Tokyo, but you're struggling to do the mental math of like how a yen translates to dollars.
Yeah.
So I'm like,
you're just constantly searching it on.
Yeah, Google. Can I afford this Ploprof? Can I afford this? You know, I'm just kind of looking, and my head was spinning. I ended up leaving with nothing. But man, the temptations are crazy.
Yeah, I looked at a bunch of stuff. I looked at some like JDM Seiko,
mm-hmm.
And I figured if I found an SLA diver,
yeah,
you know, the with the 8 series movement, that was like the price was right. I could bring that home. That's kind of still on my hit list for Seiko. Mm-hmm. Is like an SLA 017 or similar, you know, kind of take that, the SPB diver, which I've owned and loved, but take it to the final degree.
Yeah.
Before you get to a Grand Seiko.
Yeah.
I'll definitely own one of those at some point in the future. But I looked around and at one point we were in Jack Road, and that's just Jack Road's like one fairly prominent retailer. And they have old stuff, lots of old Rolex, lots of vintage stuff, but then they just have a ton of new stuff. And it's not just Omega and Rolex and that sort of thing. It's like Erwerk and Richard Mille and Porsche design, and, you know, lots of brands that you know, might start at $1,000 and kind of go up from there. And but then at the same time, you go down around the corner and there's like a display case next to Goodwatch that just had a bunch of, like, before your and my time, but like what Rolex would have given out at Baselworld.
Oh,
like,
sure.
There was a Baselworld 2011 paperweight.
Oh, wow.
You know, a desk clock and ephemera, that sort of thing. And there was just, you know, they had like stacks upon stacks of bezels and handsets.
Yeah, yeah.
And like, it was fun. I think if I had spent a day there, I would have found and convinced myself to buy something. But we spent, you know, an hour, maybe two. And then figured we would move on to kind of the next thing. And it was fun. I walked around with Andrew McCutcheon from Time and Tide. Shout out Andrew. Had a really good time because he was on the trip. And it's fun because we don't normally get to be on trips together. So
yeah.
Had a really nice couple of days with him and Brees from Monochrome, whom I'm a big fan of. And SJX was there. I've had a chance over the last year or two to become more of a pal with him. We were on the Blancpain launch for the Grand Double Sonnery last year. It was a fun trip. Always nice to be in Japan. I can't throw any shade at the idea at all. But I got to say, like, I keep looking at the notes going, how far into this show are we? Nothing else to report from your side?
No, I mean, I think you had the exciting past few days. And, you know, man, it's amazing how much you can pack into a few days halfway around the world, including flights. So, but let's dive in, because you also have some exciting news in Wrist Check, something new.
I do, yeah. I will go first, which I don't commonly do. I've teased at it over the last couple weeks, but I did actually buy a watch this year already, so I didn't quite make it a month. I have rebought a Breitling Aerospace, and I'm absolutely overjoyed to have it. In 2018, I sold my E56-062, which is an early generation, not the earliest, or an early iteration of sort of the first generation of the Aerospace. And now I have bought from Cortez on the Slack, shout out Cortez, an E65-362, which is the repetitions minute, with a sort of steely blue dial. And it's basically in perfect condition. It comes on the standard, so I would call it the chiclet. Is chiclets the gum a known thing, or is that a Canadian thing?
No, that's well known here.
So I look at these bracelet links, and I always call that. To be clear, this is not what anyone else would call this bracelet. It's not the slanted, so it's not one of the Pro series that you would instantly recognize. I call it a chiclet bracelet. It looks like pieces of those gum, all kind of stacked up. And then Cortez also threw in the RZE brushed titanium bracelet, which is probably nicer made and has quick disconnect. And has a push button extension. So that's probably the one I'll be wearing a lot on the watch, but I've thrown it back on the stock, quote unquote, titanium bracelet from Breitling, and just loving it. I absolutely love these watches. And I, you know, like I said, we can get into it. I needed money at the time. And so I sold the Aerospace, and I've kind of regretted it since. And I'm sure that's come up on, you know, numerous Q&As about watches you maybe regret selling or watches you still think about. And I remain a huge fan of these. And this is sort of the model that comes after the one I had. But early January, I think in one day, two or three really good looking Aerospaces popped up on the Slack.
Yeah.
I sent you a message about it. I was conflicted. I still wanted to sell a couple of my own watches. So we're still net down in terms of number of watches. But I have bought what appears to be essentially a like new Aerospace, full kit and everything. And I also realized I don't have any other, at least certainly not ones that I commonly wear, blue dial watches. I have sort of the pastel Halios.
Yeah.
But like your core kind of standard, you know, denim blue or whatever, I don't have. And so this gives me that option as well. And I just absolutely love it. I'm super, super thrilled. So if I let you down by buying a watch, especially one that's exceptionally similar to a watch I've already owned and adds to a stable of ever-growing analog digital nonsense in my watch box, which it's really my home for fun.
Yeah.
Is, you know, watches with tiny screens. I'm absolutely loving this. I'm going to wear it so much.
Oh yeah, it's great.
I have another trip coming up in about 12 days to Geneva for something quite exciting that I will be able to talk about a little later on. It's not a watch release. It's more of a peek behind the veil of a great watch brand that we really love on this on the show. But I'm also looking forward to putting a few travel miles on this one as well.
Yeah. So,
Yeah, pretty pumped about that. And again, shout out to Cortez on the Slack and to the Slack in general. He was able to pick it up from one of the members who had it before, and then it didn't land that well with him. And now it's with me, and I can't imagine it's going anywhere unless things get pretty dire.
Yeah, and you explained, so this is repetition minutes. I guess that's Swiss French for minute repeater, right? I mean, it does a on-demand chiming.
It does, yeah. So you can have it chime the hours, and then it a little different chime for 15 minutes, wow. And then it chimes the final digit. So that's something I haven't bothered playing with just yet. I'm kind of doling out my fun with it I've had it for at this point a few hours. I got home late.
Oh right, of course, yeah.
Immediately put it
what
on.
A way, so what a thing!
Still,
to come
still
home
very
to.
Fresh.
Yeah, and it has the rider tabs that you can swap around, like I was talking about on a previous episode.
It sure does.
Yeah,
and it's just the bezels significantly more crisp and nicely, you know, fitted than the one on my last one. There's just much less wear and tear on this model.
Yeah.
Yeah, we talked a lot about the watch on a very recent episode, so we don't have to. I'll do more in the future as I wear it more. But yeah, I'm very happy with it.
Yeah, that's great. Well, I went with the I guess you could call it an equally sketchy watch if we're kind of gonna categorize in that way. You know, Breitling with the reputation as being the watch of sketchy characters. I have on a watch that I don't know if I've talked about on the podcast before, but it's the Cobalt Endurance chronograph. I picked this up probably last fall from somebody that was selling. It was such an impulse buy off of BST on Slack. And, you know, I've worn it off and on, but not much. And I thought at some point recently I was looking at it. I thought, maybe it's time to move this on. It's not getting much wear. But I've got it on this kind of drab olive canvas from Haviston that I've had for years. And it kind of works perfectly. And so this is if you're not familiar with the Cobalt Endurance, it was, I believe it was one of their very first watches. And this one dates back to the late 90s when the company was just getting off the ground. And they were, Michael Cobalt, the founder, who's come to some controversy and fallen in some disgrace by some measures. When he set out to found the brand, he was looking for partners. And he was kind of a mentee, I guess, if you will, of Gerd Rudiger Lang, who was of ChronoSwiss, you know, founded ChronoSwiss back in the 80s, kind of was responsible for rekindling the interest in mechanical watches back then. And so he partnered with him, and then they had Zinn actually build this watch. So the crown has a C on it for ChronoSwiss, and it's basically a Zinn 103. So it's got the rotating, you know, black anodized aluminum bezel, you know, time elapsed bezel, and then it's that familiar Zinn day date, you know, 7750 based chronograph dial. And it's kind of a tough little watch. It's 40 millimeters. So, you know, Cobalt went pretty big after this with their later watches. And this one's, you know, a reasonable size. It's really comfortable. It's been accurate. It's got, you know, tritium markers in hand. So it's starting to fade a little bit. But yeah, it's a fun piece. It's I might hold on to it a little longer. So it's great.
Yeah, those are very cool. I mean, yeah, Cobalt, the interest becomes, it raises the longer that they've been kind of out of the enthusiast cycle,
yeah,
in some ways.
Yeah,
and maybe it's just that they're out of my cycle and I'm misscoping this, but when we got into, like, when we got, if I say we, you and I, Jason, like, talk 2006, 2007, I remember it being a real thing.
Yeah.
We definitely talked about this recently on, was it a Q&A, was it, it was something where we talked a bunch about Soarway divers and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
These are definitely interesting and kind of like I'm again, this could just be that it's a recursive loop. So it's not happening in enthusiasm. It's just happening in my little piece of watch internet.
Yeah.
But it feels like people are looking back at early Zinn now as like, oh, these are re-interesting. They were always interesting, like EZM1s and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But now they've become like increasingly more collectible.
Mm-hmm.
When those pop up, they feel quite special to see. It's like seeing an old Porsche design chrono or something like that.
Yeah.
I definitely get the Cobalt appeal, especially given kind of the arc that the company and its ownership has had in the last, you know, 15, 20 years.
Yeah. Yeah. And I got this one and that 144 that I got from Tom Place roughly around the same time. It was within a month of each other. And so suddenly I had two basically Zinn chronographs with the same movement in them. So it's been kind of all or nothing for me in that respect, but yeah, it's great.
Nice.
I suppose we should jump into our main topic here. We're half an hour into the show and we haven't even started talking about the past 10 years.
Yeah, I mean, if we're talking about arcs that people have had, let's make it really clear. The rest of this episode is going to be deeply navel-gazy. We're just going to be talking about what the last 10 years have been like for us. Last week, we had Mike on to talk about kind of the 10 years of our relationship with Mike and with the Watch World and that sort of thing. And now we're just kind of taking one moment. This isn't going to be a trend. This is sort of, I think, where the sort of 10-year themed topics will probably end. Maybe we'll do a 10-year Q&A in the future. If people want to send in specific questions, we could probably group those together. But I figured before we could do a Q&A or something, there's stuff we could talk about here. Some stuff that has never made it onto the show because it was too much about the show.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. But yeah, so it's been 10 years. Depending on the time zone of your podcast feed, February 1st or February 2nd, 2016 was roughly the first episode. And then, Jason, I have a really fuzzy memory. Like, I don't remember... We could try and go back and see. I'm not sure how interesting it would be, but like, I think we were probably in planning to start this for a few months. And then we finally just picked like after SIHH, we would do it.
Yeah, I think that's how it went. And I believe, you know, I know for sure that when Mike introduced us and we started talking about the podcast, you know, you had, you know, to your credit, I mean, you had this kind of idea pretty well fully, I shouldn't say fully baked, but you know, you had a pretty good idea of what you wanted to see.
Yeah.
And you even had a name for it. And I remember us talking about it and I just thought, yeah, it sounds great. I'm not sure how it works. And I remember you really had to kind of coach me through, you know, the logistics of doing the recordings. And we've done it sure. Exactly the same way for 10 years. I mean, with some
the hardware.
Minor tweaks to the hardware. But it's always been GarageBand and were we using Zoom? Was that Zoom 10 years ago or was it something?
No, we started on Skype.
Skype. Oh, Skype.
Yeah, we started on Skype. Zoom yeah. Zoom didn't really exist
I
until
20.
Like, I know it did, but like nobody knew about Zoom until the pandemic.
I do remember when we talked about, you know, I don't remember specifically, but you know, where we're going to kick things off. And it just happened to be the timing that, well, it kind of makes sense to do it after SIHH because it'll give us a big, kind of big bang, a lot of bang for the buck, a lot of things to talk about. And sure enough, that's where it was. All luxed out was the first episode.
Yeah. And I was still working full time in like the Canada's cable services industry. I worked for Shaw Cable.
Yeah.
At the time in Vancouver and was kind of building stuff out. And actually my interest in a podcast for watches probably goes back to 2010 or 2011, where I'd wanted to start one, but didn't have a host. At the time, there were very few watch podcasts out there. I was listening to the one that R.L. Adams used to do with John Biggs. Definitely at the time, I really wanted to do something like that, but within my own scope. I was obsessed with podcasts. I was listening, you know, big This Week in Tech, Leo Laporte fan, you know, anything I could get my hands on. You know, early on, it was a lot of like Strange Fiction, Weird Media stuff, and tech coverage or tech news sort of things were the early, like this would have been first year of university for me when I was listening to a lot of This Week in Tech and Dignation kind of transitioned into having something like a podcast, but it wasn't really called that yet. And you know, kind of went from there with a lot of the same sorts of folks. If you remember the 1UP podcast in the video game space, that was very formative for me. And I think if you went back and listened to some of these, you'd go like, oh, that's why TGN doesn't really feel like a modern podcast.
Mm-hmm.
it's because the ones that I really loved were these like knuckleheads who worked together in the same space and sat down and had a conversation that would kind of have happened either way, but was recorded and people who love the same sorts of things got to be part of it to a certain extent, which is sort of the vibe here. We're not necessarily telling stories. We're not necessarily, you know, reporting on something. I have a very different opinion. You know, these days, I think the closest thing that I like is like what The Ringer does,
mm-hmm.
whether it's The Big Picture or Rewatchables or any of the other dozens of shows that they're capable of making. I think that's the thing where you get people who have something to chit chat about or would be doing it with their friends anyways, putting it on tape. And that was always the goal.
Mm-hmm.
Once I got to get to know you better and we were kind of constantly chatting on like Gmail chat or Google chat, G chat, whatever they were calling it at the time. And I started to see like, oh, I think this would be the guy to do it with. pretty choosy on that front. So, you know, obviously I'm pretty happy with how that's worked out. It's been 10 largely drama free years. And then, yeah, I remember just kind of saying like, look, you'll record your side, I'll record mine, and I'll figure out a way to cut them together. So it sounds like we're in the same room.
Yeah.
I didn't have any audio editing experience, not anything extensive, nothing to this extent. If you go back, they don't sound amazing. But I think we crossed that line. You know, I think I've called it like the 70% threshold.
Mm-hmm.
There's like a line where as long as it's good enough to be clear and doesn't mess with your speakers in your car or your earphones, like it's in the right scope, it's good enough.
Yeah.
You know, over time, I think we definitely made it sound a little bit better and make some tweaks to the way that we were editing the show. And I don't exhaustively edit as much as I used to. I'll leave in more errors or natural speech patterns and that sort of thing. But yeah, that's sort of where we started it, was in February of 2016. And at the time we were two episodes a month. So a much slower cadence than we have now. And I would say that we largely just kind of figured it out as we went from there.
Mm-hmm.
Like there wasn't like a grand plan. There wasn't a business plan. Certainly we never intended to make any money doing this. And I think largely for me, it was one of those things where I got so tired of thinking about doing it that I stopped being worried about like making it perfect. And the goal just became making it the show. And then I would say, you know, and we've said this before, we got really lucky because within a week, Ben Clymer at Hodinkee, now my boss and has been for some time, but at the time was just kind of a guy we knew in the space. I don't know if I had met Ben more than once or twice before that, you know, in my Blog to Watch years.
Yeah.
He wrote a story just saying, hey, the podcast is out. It's good. If you like the sorts of watches that these guys like, you're going to like this podcast, which I think is still true. And that made a huge difference. That gave us our first bump of notoriety, of Google search results, of, you know, attention from a huge audience at Hodinkee. And I think, you know, a tiny, you know, fraction of 1% of that audience kind of liked what they heard and has stuck around. Some are still listening, which is great. Yeah. You know, we hear from people who say they're on since day one, which is great. And certainly we have some data to suggest that's the case. Do you remember anything specific about those early bits, like up until, you know, we did maybe what, a year and a half without any real slowdown?
Well, I just remember when occasionally we'll have a guest on who feels very nervous about talking on a podcast and just wondering how it's going to go. And, you know, we kind of reassure them, look, it's just a conversation. It gets edited. I remember feeling those things in the early days. I think you had more confidence in kind of, you know, speaking and the editing process and kind of how it all was going to work. And I just remember thinking like, I need like a script. Like, I think I used to type out like things that I was going to say about specific topics, not word for word, but like, you know, extensive notes. And it's gotten to the point now where, you know, it could be an hour before we're going to record. And we're like, what do you want to talk about today? You know, what do you want to do for a topic? Yep. I think we just have that chemistry and kind of this legacy behind us of just comfort. And
for sure.
And so that works really well. But yeah, you know, those early days, thinking back to 2016, 2017, you know, I was in the thick of kind of kicking off my, you know, full-time freelance career. I had gone full-time freelance in about, I believe, 2014. And so I was taking any trip I could get, you know, press trips and writing any sort of story for, you know, Ask Men and Hodinkee and Revolution and Gear Patrol and whatever. And I was super busy. And, you know, the podcast was something that doing twice a month was sustainable. It wasn't too hard to do. You did the bulk of the work with the editing and the publishing. But then there was a point in, you know, 2018 where we kind of decided to take some time off in the summer. I think things had just gotten hectic or busy or, you know, who knows, but things in our personal lives. And we decided to take a break. And I just remember feeling kind of blasé about coming back. I think I just got used to kind of not doing it for a couple of days and thinking, you know, this isn't a money-making thing. This isn't like something that's enhancing my income and I'm busy enough with all these freelance projects. You know, maybe we kind of don't come back after the summer. And I remember telling you that and you're like, well, what can we do? Cause you know, you still really wanted to continue and I was on the fence and we're like, well, what can change? Let's adapt things. And I guess that was around the time when we were, I don't remember how it came about, but we were approached by Hodinkee to kind of partner with them on an ad deal that would, you know, they would kind of publicize each of the episodes, and then we would share some ad revenue with them. Do you remember how specifically that came about?
Yeah, for sure. So early summer in 2018, we always, I think at the time we were in the mode of taking a break, or maybe the show was so new, we had we just kind of did whatever we felt. And we took a break. And largely, I think that break was downstream of you were doing a string of trips, if I remember correctly, and there wasn't going to be like a natural time to record any of it.
Mm, could be.
And this is before we were comfortable with like, take a mic with you and we'll figure it out.
Yeah.
I think one or two of them was quite remote. There might've been some time in Sri Lanka where it wasn't going to work, or the internet wasn't going to be good enough or something like that. There were some unknowns.
Yeah.
And you seemed eager to take a break. So we took a break. And then over the course of that break, we had a couple chats that were kind of like, I don't know where this is going. And or not even that you didn't know where it was going, but kind of like, it isn't going anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
We're just kind of talking for an hour.
Yeah.
Every couple weeks.
Yeah.
And putting it on the internet, and that, you know, maybe the show was, we were never that concerned about like growth or its impact or that sort of thing, but it didn't feel like the show was adding value in scope, that sort of thing. And I think you were at the point in your life where you were working a lot to keep all the balls in the air. And I don't think having something that took the time and occasionally took time out of some of the other experiences that you were trying to do made sense when it didn't make any money, when it didn't have that impact on the goals of the rest of your existence.
Mm-hmm.
If I remember correctly, that's kind of the discussions that we were having. So I just figured I would find a way to have it make a little bit of cash and see if that made more sense. You got to get your time paid. We'd put the time in by this point to kind of develop what the show was and some of the aesthetic and the logo, and you know, the name had held, you know, the Grenado, you know, it was obtuse enough that we weren't getting any general audience. You know, probably, let's be clear, probably would have been smart to have just called it like the Adventure Watch Podcast or something like that.
Right.
If you want to look back over 10 years of possible mistakes or things I would or wouldn't change, I wouldn't change the name. But I've definitely been told by lots of people who are smarter that the name is dumb and hard for people to understand. I don't care.
Yeah.
I think it's worked out just fine. I like that after 10 years, I still have to explain it to people occasionally, like what the intent is. Does it have anything to do with the, you know, like NATO proper? No, that sort of thing. So yeah, that's all fine by me.
As an aside too, that name does elicit some interesting, promotional emails from PR people that are like,
oh yeah,
wanting to pitch us to talk about, you know, geopolitical experts that are talking about the role of NATO in the modern era or something. Like, oh, you got the wrong NATO. Yeah.
Wrong one. but yeah, so I went to Hodinkee and just said, hey, look, these are our metrics. And we would like to, we would be available if there's some sort of a deal that we would like to put together for any of this, let me know.
Were you on staff there at that time? No,
I was, so by 2017, I had taken essentially a stronger role with them. So I was on retainer, for a certain number of stories a month and had taken, like, I was no longer a contributor. I think I was classed as an editor, there at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so we started working with them, as an ad deal where if they sold an ad on the show, we would get half the cash. And in return, we would bolster, you know, by calling the, you can go back and listen to these episodes. We're not changing any of this, of course. And I'm so pretty proud that we did this for when we did it. We put the, you know, it's a Hodinkee podcast or whatever was the sort of tag. It was like a licensing deal with them. And it turned out that even when we weren't the ones selling or administrating the ads, it was still a pain.
Mm-hmm.
You and I are not like businessmen. We're not great at making money. I don't want to do this side of the job. That's kind of why I made a podcast that was obtuse and difficult to, like, it was never going to be this commercial giant, which I'm fine with. I think that at that point you eventually lose the show and the point of what we were trying to do. So we stuck around for a long time with them. I don't know that I never signed anything that said I couldn't talk with us. We were pretty far along in possibly selling the show to Hodinkee.
Yeah.
We had numbers, we had the need for lawyers, we had stuff like that. And then with a venture capital move, they bought Crown and Caliber, which kind of left us not being purchased. And that's one of those ones where I look back and I'm very thankful that it worked out the way that it did, simply because I don't know if you stacked up everything that Hodinkee was up to, it wouldn't have put us at the very high on the priority list, understandably so from a business side. And at about April 2021, it was episode 143 was the last one we did. And we ended that agreement with Hodinkee. And I would say what we learned was quite important, which is giving up any control is giving up control of something that we like. And two, we weren't going to do the ad thing. Even if we had to do it or someone else, it wasn't going to work. Wasn't going to work for us. Didn't like the way it worked. I might reconsider that if it meant saving the show again in the future. But if it would be a last ditch sort of option, the interest was always to transition to being listener supported. You know, by now we're talking April 2021. Listener support is becoming even more accepted for some of these things. And you know, during the time with Hodinkee, we also started going weekly for the isolation tapes. So originally I branded it the isolation tape so that we could dial it back and not stay weekly. I was scared of setting a commitment that we couldn't get out of.
Yeah. Yeah. It was going to be a temporary thing.
Yeah, exactly. So when we started the isolation tapes, it was because we were all home, you know, starting in March of 2020 due to the pandemic. And I thought, hey, this gives us the ability to brand something where we can go weekly. But then when the isolation tapes are over, we go back to being bi-weekly or bi-monthly. You take your pick. I still don't understand all those terms. Twice a month was the goal. We would go back to that. I think you and I, Jason, were on the same page for that. And then we just never did.
Yeah.
Because by then the show really started to find it's like its home, its cadence. From a value statement, a show like TGN's very much a preaching to the choir, rather than trying to get more people in the pews sort of scenario, to use the church analogy. And then by April 2021, we were out of Hodinkee and kind of looking to figure out what we would do from there. And in May of 2021, I believe it was May, there was a fairly large-scale outage on SoundCloud, which is what we had used for 170-some-odd episodes by that point, or pushing maybe 155 episodes, something like that. And it was offline for a long time. And it was this came at a time when it really felt like we were finally, things were coming into play for us. You know, the show was pretty good. The audience was really on board. And so we switched over to Substack for the show notes. And then in a similar scope, we moved from SoundCloud to Buzzsprout for subsidized or like for distributing the actual feed for the show.
Well, and I'll just interject here too on the Substack side of things. At the time we were trying to figure out a way that we could move to a subscriber based platform, and, right. and we kicked around some ideas, you know, Patreon or some others, and it was around the late summer of the pandemic year that I had started my own kind of Substack for writing, and it was building a small subscriber base there. And I thought, you know, I suggested, well, we could use that. And it's, you know, looking back, I think we're ambivalent about that move, and maybe there was a different way to do it. And we might still migrate at some point. It probably would be a pretty big lift at this point to kind of move people over to a different platform. But Substack's really built, and they've changed over the years, and they're doing a lot of new things now with, you know, video platform and kind of chats and social media feeds and that sort of thing. But it really is really made for kind of writing and video and that sort of thing, or hosting a podcast on its platform.
Right.
It just created a vehicle by which we could collect kind of subscriber roles and post the notes, but it hasn't been perfect.
No, I would actually say in the things I would go back and change, Substack's probably the big one. If it was something I could do simply, I really wish we had gone with Patreon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It would just have given us so much more power to speak directly to the folks that are most engaged, our best audience.
Mm-hmm.
And I really wish we'd either gone with an entirely our own system for doing it. I'm not sure how you would have done that at the time. It's definitely easier to do now, or something like a Patreon, which just gives you much more ability to segment and push content directly to the people who are willing and wanting to pay for it. It's that sort of stuff. So it's a lot of ham-fisted sort of done by hand stuff that we would have avoided mm-hmm. if we'd gone a different way. That said, to distribute the show notes as an email, great platform. Just a frustrating thing to try and do anything that they're not prepared or interested in doing, or in any way that they're not. And it doesn't seem to matter if you make the money or you don't, or that sort of thing. So what are you going to do? It's definitely something I would, if I could go back, I would do it differently.
And I think it's there's also, once you start layering these different platforms that we're using, you know, Substack and Slack and Buzzsprout and, you know, all the podcast platforms and players and things, it gets to be confusing. It's a lot for people to manage. And they're like, what, you know, people that maybe aren't quite as tech savvy are like, what's the difference between Substack and Slack and whatever. And we can get into Slack here in a bit, because Slack is another big piece of TGN mm-hmm. over the past few years. But
yeah, I was only really summarizing us up to this line in the sand of the Substack working and us bringing in paid subscribers, because I don't really know, and it's tough to remember. The latter half of 2018, early 2019 was a really terrible point in my life. I went through a divorce, which we've never talked about on the show. And I'm surprised that I made any good decisions about the future of what I wanted to do, whether it was my work with Hodinkee or TGN or any of that. And I think just keeping that ball rolling kind of got us eventually to 2021, where things started to click and we were able to start building something that really was recursive to the people who wanted it.
Yeah. I think, you know, there's a lot that, you know, as quote unquote public figures, we kind of keep behind the curtain. You know, personal lives sneak out sometimes, as we've seen, you know, recently. And you know, we've both been through divorces. I even went through one in 2024, and, you know, we don't really talk about these things on the show. I mean, people know there's hints out there, and people, you know, can speculate and find things out in other ways. But I guess the moral of the story for me is that, you know, even though we don't talk about these things or elicit, you know, sympathy or feedback or anything from the audience, the vibe, the general sort of warmth that we get from the community and just from doing it, and, you know, frankly, our friendship has just been such a sustaining thing in my life. And I think I get that feedback. We get that feedback a lot from listeners as well. I've so many private messages and emails and things from people that are going through things and struggles, and I think they do appreciate that, you know, we kind of, you know, we let on some things about our personal lives, and we field questions from people and whatever. And I just think it's been a two-way street. You know, I think it's been a really valuable, huge, positive influence in my life. I mean, possibly the most positive thing in the past 10 years, really.
Yeah, I don't disagree on that front. You know, I think for me, I'm very compartmentalized as a human being. It could be from doing a show for 10 years where I could say too much about my personal life or too little or whatever, that I've just built up sort of these walls, and it never felt like a safe space to talk about some of this stuff in the public sense. And I think since then we found that the Q&A episodes can often become quite personal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had a question recently from somebody asking about how do you factor for like personal selfishness mm-hmm. in the way that you exist in life. And I think that's the most feedback I've gotten about anything I've said on the show in years.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm not saying that necessarily some of these topics are things that I want to talk about. The fact that I didn't is probably a suggestion that I don't want to talk about them, but, it's not that they didn't exist. You know what I mean? Or like we didn't go through it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for me, looking back on the 10 years of TGN, it's not so much that it's remarkable that we made a show or that people enjoy it. I'm incredibly thankful for that. And I think a lot of it's luck or whatever other term you might give for it. The thing that's remarkable to me is that we didn't stop making it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I think there were lots of options where you could just say like, dude, this is,
mm-hmm.
why don't you just call me? We'll just have a phone call. Why do we have to record it? Why does it have to be online? Why does it have to be part of this thing? Or why does it have to stack on top of, you know, at a certain point, if you're going through a tough time, and it could be any sort of a tough time, it could be an illness, it could be problems in your family, it could be whatever, work stress, all those sorts of things. It's a weird thing to get on the mic and just kind of have to put all of that to the side for a little bit to do what this is.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I think I've learned a lot about that sort of thing and where certain topics exist and where they don't and that sort of thing. But yeah, I think it's remarkable that for me, the biggest achievement is that we didn't stop.
Well, it got to a point, I think a tipping point or an inflection point where I started to feel like no matter what's going on in my or our personal lives, I started to feel a real accountability and commitment to doing what we do, because I sensed that there was some impact and it was developing these very real, although virtual or distant, friendships with people. Just felt like a link.
Yeah. And I think, you know, over that era, just post pandemic, we started doing the occasional, like we'd show up and hang out or a wind up or now Toronto timepiece show or Vancouver timepiece show or whatever, hangouts at various breweries and places. And I think as soon as you start doing that and meeting people face to face, you realize like and it's not like, oh, look what a great job we did, but just like the fact that we make it and we're out there and we kind of do things to a certain tenor people seem to attach to, or a certain type of person kind of attaches to. And certainly some of those people become pretty good friends.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you remember our first, I think it might've been our first in-person sort of hangout, which was very informal, and it was in New York after one of the days of the Hodinkee 10 tenure.
During H10 at that bar next to Washington Square Park.
Yeah. Yeah, it was. I remember Robert Spangl showed up and, you know, a handful of other people, and it wasn't a big gathering, but it was fun. And if there was a 15 or 20
people,
yeah, it was great.
Yeah, that was such a reprieve. You know, that December of 2018 was not a great one. You know, it was a lot of change happening all at once.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've said it before, but if you're into these watches, if you're into these things, if you're into the final notes, you're probably the right type of person to be a pal.
Yeah,
to some extent, and we've certainly seen that kind of play out in real life. So yeah, I do believe that was our first quote unquote like TGN hangout, and yeah, man, that feels like a long time ago, because it was a long time ago.
Well, we should probably start to wrap things up a bit, but I did want to just ask you a question about, you know, we've done so many things over the years, you know, different kind of special projects with raffles to raise money. Mm-hmm. And we've done some partnerships, of course, with CWC and Tactile Turn, and we've done episodes about those things. But we've had a lot of great guests on the show, and I'm just curious if there's one that stands out that was maybe your favorite, or maybe one or two.
Man, that's pretty tough.
Yeah.
You know, Don Walsh.
Mm, mm-hmm.
It's pretty incredible to have him on, you know, before he passed. I remember the one that I sat on my end of the call and my brain just it went in 20 different directions because of the quality of the guest. And we could have him back on, I think, pretty easily.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't really know why we haven't, but David Concannon.
Yeah.
His Substack is fantastic. He's just an amazing guest.
Mm-hmm.
And every now and then he sends me an email that's just full of like wisdom and kindness that I don't necessarily deserve.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's just a really fascinating guy. You know, I loved having Rebecca Struthers on.
Yeah.
I thought she was amazing. And I've traded a couple emails with her, you know, for other stuff since. And dude, it's tough. Richie Kohler,
mm-hmm.
the Pantheon or whatever, the web of TGN, like the Shadow Divers is such a kind of a core text, mm-hmm. if you will,
yeah,
in the syllabus reading. And to have Richie on
required reading for TGN.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Which I thought was amazing. You know, we had a chance to really speak with some people who are in so deep into their part of a slice of what we love, like clothing, like from Steve Tidball from Volabach to Abe from Outlier Clothing that's quite a long time ago. That's an episode from a long, long time ago. Man, it's kind of tough. I mean, we've had Ballesta on multiple times. That's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. He was a real highlight for me. Richie Kohler really stands out. And then, you know, we had a great chat with Sean Lurwill, if you remember. He was a fitness coach and former Royal Marine, like just a great episode there. And then more recently, we did that episode with Ben Fogel, the
amazing guy,
co-owner now of Buffalo Systems and a TV presenter from the UK. And I loved the things he had to say. He was very humble, and that was great. It's too many to list. I mean, I'm kind of blown away that we've
had Pennington, three times. Names.
Yeah. Yeah. Henry Catchpole.
Henry Catchpole, Thomas Holland.
Yeah, Megan Hine. I mean, we've had some. Yeah. I'd love
my buddy Gajan Balan, incredible episode.
Yeah, I'd love to put a roster together of all the guests we've had. It's pretty mind-blowing, actually. It was great.
When we do like the TGN 25 international meetup, we'll bring all these people out and put them all on a stage or whatever. But yeah, I mean the guest thing is wild, because I think you'll remember, like, deep on, I think I said pretty clearly, like, I didn't, this wasn't going to be a guest show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It felt like that was the way other watch podcasts were going, like, oh, we have so-and-so from this brand, we have so-and-so from this Instagram account or whatever. And I wanted it to be like this sort of old school, early podcast, two buddies kind of kicking it back.
Mm-hmm.
But man, the episodes about, if I put James Bond in the title,
yeah,
we get
yeah.
good results.
Right.
And if we put like a Cole or a Henry. Some of the guests can really change the tenor. And, you know, that we've had Jason Lim on from Halios early on, not a guy that does a lot of podcast appearances. We've had lots of Jasons. Jason Gallup, of course, has been on a couple times.
Right.
And then I think if you look back at the two potluck episodes we've done from mm-hmm. the Toronto Timepiece shows, those sit for me as like pretty special things that I'm really proud of.
Yeah.
Already looking forward to, you know, figuring out who we'll have on for the 2026 Toronto Timepiece show. Mm-hmm. And that sort of thing. But yeah, the guests have been really, really a thing. And we've definitely had some amazing ones. I mean, Jack Carr's.
Yeah.
Talk about a big deal, right? Right.
Yeah.
And then since then I read every one of his books and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, we've been very fortunate when it comes to guests and to people like members of our audience being like, hey, I'll connect you with so-and-so. I know them through a friend or I'm a buddy of theirs. And it, you know, some people can be like very selfless with that, that sort of connection. And then there's lots of people I'm embarrassed to say there's lots of people where you get that connection and you send an email and they're busy or you're busy on the reply and it just never really comes together. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it can take like a year or 2 years to for all of it to kind of align and have people be ready. And sometimes you get the sense that they really don't understand the show and then you worry that it won't work. And that sort of thing. So yeah, it's a delicate math when you're not really a guest driven show.
Yeah.
To find the ones that make sense to break up that cadence, but for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, yeah, I would say that the big era for me, the era where we go way more in terms of depth starts in, what, November of 22 and brings us to now, which is kind of the slack era of the mm-hmm. show.
Yeah.
Kick that off. I don't think we ever imagined it would be more than 200-300 guys in there chit-chatting about whatever. And now it's taken on a life of its own. It requires our incredible moderator team. Shout out to Jake and Chris and Jackson for all their help. But there's also, you know, lots of other guys that are there just to be supportive. We don't necessarily call them moderators, but they take on a charge of bringing people up to speed on how things are done and making sure that when a BST post isn't right, they, you know, put the red flag on it and that kind of thing. And it's a it's really a team effort. And it's something where I don't think you and I can take any credit for what the Slack has become or how it is. It's absolutely a little town, a city of its own. And I'm proud to have been the one to turn on the free service with Slack, but like, let's not take too much credit here. That's something where we're able to really see the idea of community. Like this is something we're largely hands off. I go in there to have fun. It's not work, for the most part when I go in there and it's become my number one social media. I get, you know, with the way the world is these days, I get further and further from Instagram and I've lost my login recently to LinkedIn. So I hope everything's okay over there. and yeah, I pretty much just, you know, I just do the Slack and I check it a couple times a day and it's great. It's great. It's a great place to be kept honest about things and get feedback. And if I'm going to eat crow, that's where the plate will come from for sure, which is fine.
Yeah.
And, but it's also been a place of real learning and a place to go deep on things and get connected with people who know way more than we do. And also to find perspectives that I just don't think about.
Yeah. And it's really transcended the podcast to the point where I almost get a glimpse sometimes, you know, sitting back quietly, looking at the discussions going on that I think, heaven forbid, and this isn't going to happen anytime soon, but if we ever stop the podcast, this is just, TGN could go on, you know, TGN just goes on in the Slack. Like it's become that, it's become the community more than just you and I talking. And it's,
I think so.
It's really encouraging. Yeah. Pretty amazing.
Yeah. And who knows, you know, we didn't set out thinking we would do 10 years or we never really found a reason to stop making it. And that in many ways, making it became this sort of catharsis through the reasons that might have stopped the show at times.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, there's, you know, it's 10 years of learnings and some mistakes and all that kind of stuff, but there's very little that I would go back and change from a content standpoint or a community standpoint or anything like that. It's all kind of tech stuff.
Yeah.
With the abundance of perspective that comes from looking backwards, there's things I might have done a little bit differently, but
yeah,
no major problems there. And yeah, it's kind of fun to look back. Like I don't think we'd make more than one episode a decade, kind of like this. that's a solid hour of kind of talking about ourselves and what we did. And you know, I think the only way to get us to final notes here would be to say thank you.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, for those of you who have been around since 2016. Can't appreciate you enough. For those of you who have come in and out of the show, thank you for giving it another try. And for those of you who are more recent, I hope you enjoy it. I hope you know that if you want to be part of any of the additional ones, we've never raised the price of the supporter bundle, which largely, let's be clear, the $5 is because you like the show and you want to be in the Slack, or really for some people I've learned is just the Slack, and that's fine. Mm-hmm. I think that's fine. I think that if the Slack is I believe it to be worth the money, as I believe the show is worth $5. It's so little money.
Yeah.
But we, you know, we've occasionally, what, Jason, maybe every 2 years we go, do you think we should raise the price? And we just quickly talk ourselves out of it. Yeah. So, you know, we lean on things like merch or the CWN1 for a little bit of a bump, mm-hmm. Every now and then. But it's largely worked out. And I just have a huge thank you to the guests who've been on the show, to the people who have promoted the show for us, to those of you who have told your friends about the show, to those of you who've been listening and send emails when things don't feel great, or send emails when you're happy about something, or send emails when you don't understand or want to share something. All of that's incredible. And same on the Slack. And yeah, Jason, anything to add for that?
No, I just want to thank you too for picking me as a co-host.
Oh,
and sticking with me for 10 years.
No, I would say much thank you for not quitting. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I feel like I was destined to do this to some extent, and there are alternative timelines where it was with different people and it didn't last for sure. I think this is the best case, and it's been a treat making, you know, I guess maybe when you factor for all of them, a little over 400 yeah. episodes over wow. the years. And I look forward to whatever we're, you know, sort of blessed enough to continue to make.
All right. Well, with that, we've probably talked about ourselves enough here. We can move on to final notes and wrap it up here.
All right. You want to go first? I went first for a risk check.
Sure. Yep. So, you know, a couple of weeks ago, maybe three episodes ago, I talked about reading a book by one of our listeners, Michael O'Donnell. It was called Concert Black, which I recommended. It's forthcoming. It comes out in April. Michael had earlier sent me his first novel. This was a couple of years ago, called Above the Fire, and I never read it. Sorry, Michael. I read your second book first. But then I found his first novel, Above the Fire, on my shelf, and I pulled it out and I started reading it. And I have to say, I highly recommend it. I think it's incredibly TGN, if you kind of consider all the things we talk about. It's about a father and son who are hut-to-hut hiking in the White Mountains out in New Hampshire. And they get word while they're, you know, at one of the huts that something has happened back in civilization, a major power cut, internet outage, basically a big cyber attack that has kind of thrown the country into chaos. And they're forced to stay in the mountains indefinitely, kind of through the winter, and stay in one of these remote huts. And it just has so much going for it. It's I wouldn't call it an adventure thriller or, you know, anything like that, but it has these elements of, you know, wilderness adventure, fatherhood, you know, a lot of introspection. It's really quite well written. Michael's a fantastic writer. There's even a mechanical chronograph that is unnamed, but comes into play quite a bit. It's passed on from somebody to the young son in the story, and he uses it for very specific purposes. I highly recommend this book. It was published in December of 2023, so that one is available. So you can go ahead and order that. We'll put a Goodreads link in the show notes, and you can check that out. But congratulations, Michael. I really enjoyed that book. I can't decide which book I liked better. I think this one's a little more in my wheelhouse, and I think people would dig it. So Above the Fire, Michael O'Donnell.
All right, Michael. $10 for the Kindle. Buying it live on the show. Let's go.
It's great.
Yeah. Looking forward to it.
All right, what do you got? You got a cool bag.
Yeah, I got a cool bag. Look, given the topic of the show, I wanted to bring it home with something we talk about, or we used to talk about all the time. And then I really did set out to try to slow down when it came to constantly buying bags. And so over the last little while with the job with Hodinkee, I now travel a fair bit to New York for like 1 or 2 days. And I'm not taking a bunch of camera gear. I'm taking a computer. And in the summer, I probably don't even need a suitcase. I just need a large enough bag, overnight style bag that can hold a laptop. But I also need it to kind of suit both my style, but also, you know, a proper business environment, if you will. And so over some time, I started to consider a few different options. In the past, maybe even talked about on a very early TGNs, I had like a Filson 256, like the standard, you know, like the standard heavy twill tan laptop bag.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember finding that quite rigid and heavy, and it picked up a ton of like blue dye from my jeans at the time, just walking back and forth in Vancouver.
Yeah.
And then I kind of stopped thinking about Filson. But then I got back into the research, went down some deep Reddit and YouTube rabbit holes of like great 24-hour to, you know, a little bit longer style bags that were small enough to go under the seat in front of you. but still big enough to actually carry some stuff. And so a little while ago, I figured I would swing by the Filson store in New York, where they carry pretty much everything, and check out their 24-hour tin cloth briefcase. So the tin cloth is a lighter, thinner, more pliable fabric than the twill. And in person, like within 10 seconds, I was like, I like this. This is so much less rigid and heavy than I was expecting a Filson bag to be. But it's not, you know, they do another model that's down. I'll include the link. I don't remember what it's called. That's down one from that. That's made out of more like a nylon. And I think the nylon would be fine. I'm still very much trying to do a buy once, cry once. So if I'm going to bother with it, I'll buy the one that I think will last the longest.
Yeah.
So I went in to check this out. And at the time, I walked into the store with my Topo Global briefcase. And that's what I had been using for these sorts of trips. And I just, it really felt a little bit too adventure themed, a little bit too like outdoor, colorful. It didn't suit the style I was looking for. And with the backpack straps tucked in, it's kind of awkward and it looks a little bit kludgy for going to and from, you know, the business. I wanted something with the luggage pass through. I wanted something with a little bit more room with a laptop dependency, but I didn't need the backpack straps or that sort of thing. So I kind of wanted to check out this 24-hour tin cloth. I got there. They had the green and the tan. I was really waffling between the two. Which do you pick? And then the guy from the store says, well, there is one more color. but it's not on the website. It's limited edition. And I think we have one left. And I go, well, what's the color? He goes, orange. I go, well, I think we'll have to see that. I kind of like orange, as you might expect. And so they brought it out. And if I say it's like a perfect orange where it's still orange, but it's rustic enough without being that like burnt color.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like between a sporting orange and like a burnt color of brownish orange.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's perfect. And immediately I was like, oh, let's just do that. And then we get up to the counter and, you know, Filson bags are not cheap, nor should they be. They, you know, these are, you know, pretty widely well-regarded and well-made sorts of things. It was also on sale because it was the last one. So I got 30% off of something I was going to buy at the full price anyways, quite happily. And I carried around New York, has been using it for a while since. And then I took it as my main bag for Tokyo. So laptop, a camera, you know, flash and microphone rig, the spare bits, my, you know, the other stuff I travel with all fits in there. So it carries this, not the same amount of camera gear, but otherwise it carries very similarly to my tech tote, which is my absolute favorite thing to carry when I, like if I go to a, probably if I go to like a Watches and Wonders or like a major trip where I'm carrying a lot of gear, that's what I would put it all in. But I mean, I got my SL2 with a spare lens, the flash, the rest of it all in this bag, and it, you know, just sits right on top of your luggage. It's got the pass through. During the day, if I wanted to put only a couple things in it, the camera, a spare layer, you know, bits and bobs, throw it right over your shoulder and it just looks like a Filson. The orange makes it kind of uncommon, but kind of people don't realize, like, you know, the green or the tan, especially the tan, is very Filson.
Yeah.
So yeah, I absolutely love it. It's great.
Yeah. Yeah. It's beautiful. I mean, I remember you sent me the picture of it. It's, you really got lucky with the orange. I mean, I like Filson stuff anyway. I like their other colors. The green is nice. I actually have one of their, I don't know if it was classified as a tin cloth, but I have one of their camera, old school camera bags that they did in partnership with Magnum Photography years ago. It was like a Steve McCurry collaboration or something like that. And,
oh, cool.
And it's great. It has the padded dividers, but you can take that out, but it's kind of the classic shape of a camera bag, but it's that same material with the bridal leather straps and kind of closures and toggles and things like that. And it's really nice. I just don't have much use for carrying a lot of that big camera gear around anymore. But yeah, you've intrigued me now with this because I've always liked the feel and look of that. And it's just, they have such an incredible durable feel. The zippers are big and chunky. Yeah, it just feels like something you'll have, like you said, buy once, cry once.
So yeah, I may eventually kind of dig up a camera insert that could slide in there depending on the width. I just have to do a little bit of measuring. But otherwise, I found it to be quite useful. And we'll see. It might even be the bag I take to Watches and Wonders.
Oh, nice.
So we'll see what kind of gear I feel like I absolutely have to bring for that this year. But I had a bunch of other stuff on the list to talk about. I've got a new flash, which is just significantly smaller. I'm not sure if that's as interesting of a final notes. But I felt, you know, looking back at 10 years, one of the topics we talk endlessly about is bags. And I've got another one that I just absolutely love. So if you have bags and you're happy with them, don't buy any. But if you feel like you've got a hole for a 24-hour, 48-hour sort of bag for travel that's quite flexible and looks really good, I highly recommend the 24-hour tin cloth briefcase from Filson.
Cool. Yeah, very fitting final note. Good one.
Yeah, I thought it suited.
Yeah.
All right. Well, hey, as we said, thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to subscribe to the show notes, get into the comments for each episode, consider supporting the show directly. And that would mean you could get yourself a new TGN signed NATO. You get into the Slack. You get the monthly Q&A episode, all that kind of stuff. Just visit thegraynato.com for more details. And music throughout is Siesta by Jazzar via the Free Music Archive.
As it's been since episode one. Mm-hmm. And we leave you with a very clever quote from Zadie Smith, who said, "The past is always tense, the future perfect."